From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Did you know that the great jazz singer and bandleader Cab Calloway has played Wilmington? Or that a group of slaves working at the Bellamy Mansion during the Civil War hijacked a skiff and sailed to the Union blockade seeking asylum? Or that the first Charlestown in the Southeast started in Brunswick County? Whether you're new to the area or just learning about the region's history, or you've been here for many years and are too embarrassed to admit you don't know the story of the Wilmington 10 or what the Bellamy Mansion actually is, now's your chance to find out safely and anonymously. Our two guests today are both consummate authorities on local and regional history. They both bring some personal history to the conversation, and they're well known through their high-profile day jobs. Tony Rivenbark is the executive director of the Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts. He's also written a book, Images of America, Thalian Hall, documenting the history of the building that has for so many decades served as the seat of the cultural and political landscape in Wilmington. Tony Rivenbark, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also with us today, he's a well-known staff reporter and columnist at the Star News, as well as the organizer and host of WHQR's live prologue event, the Monday Night Book Discussions, here in the MC Ernie Gallery. Ben Steelman, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And you are invited to join the conversation. Do you have a question about local history? Have you heard a rumor that you'd like to confirm or debunk? Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send your comments or questions to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. And we'll start today with the Civil War era. We will certainly backtrack and take a look at earlier periods later in the show, but this is front of mind for many, largely because of the recent nationwide controversy over the Confederate flag after nine people died in a shooting inside an AME church in Charleston, South Carolina. And today, the Star News has published an extensive piece by Julian March on the front page about the renewed scrutiny over Civil War Confederate symbols and names that are used here in this area. In Curie Beach, there's a President Davis Avenue in Pine Valley, which was the focus of the article. There's a Robert E. Lee Drive. There's a Bedford Forest Drive. Bedford Forest, as I understand it, led the Ku Klux Klan. Considering what these names represent, Ben Steelman, how and why have they been memorialized here?
Well, partly Southerners, white Southerners, were very proud of that part of their heritage. It also underlined certain Southern values, particularly, unfortunately, resistance to desegregation. It's sort of not too coincidental that the Pine Valley names were kind of adopted in the 1960s during the Civil Rights era. But it's a reflection of the South.
And Tony Rivenbark, you have some interesting family history with this, your perspective.
Well, I'm from Eastern North Carolina. My family have been there on both sides, you know, going back to before the Revolution. And so certainly I had ancestors that fought in the Confederate Army. And as I was very interested in the Civil War, you know, when I was in high school, and of course that was the 60s, which was the 100th anniversary. And I was president of the Duplin County Children of the Confederacy chapter and came to Wilmington when they had the state conference and all this stuff. So I was part of all of that stuff. I never thought of it in terms of racially, though. It all had to do with about the war and young guys love playing battles, fighting battles, whatever it is, and we just happened to do the Civil War. It was a colorful and interesting period. Only as time went on and went going to school, and then the school was integrated, but then particularly into college, starts seeing things in a different kind of light. And as most of us, or many, certainly a great many people in the South, have, you know, changed a lot of those attitudes and have become, you know, what was not acceptable when we were kids and we never questioned it is something that now we do question. about those things.
And you told me earlier, Tony, that you took down a picture recently of Robert E. Lee. Tell us why you decided to do that.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, one time I was talking to somebody and they made some comment about me and they said, oh, you're just like the people that ride around in a pickup truck with a Confederate flag and a gun rack on your car. And it irritated me, so I went home and pulled out all my Confederate stuff and put it up. But gradually over the years, I put it away. And the other day, this recent business, this terrible situation in Charleston. And I said, you know, I don't need a picture of Robert E. Lee hanging him. You know, it was a tiny one on the shelf. I don't really need that anymore. Plus the fact I don't have enough room for everything anyway. So I've pulled whatever little bit there was left. Like I said, because I think it belongs in a museum. Now, it might be a play sometimes doing where that's important as a piece of set decoration. But personally, I don't need it anymore.
Ben Steelman, you also grew up in North Carolina.
Yeah, I can actually top Tony. I'm a sort of sideways descendant of Robert Frederick Hoke, the Confederate general who was camped out at Sugarloaf while Fort Fisher was falling. That's a whole different story. My father's name was Hoke Steelman. So anyway, so that's a little that was a minor point of pride. Of course, white Southerners need to be reminded that not all of their neighbors feel the same way about their heritage as we might, and that we have to admit that yes, probably slavery is a horror, and yes, the right side won the war, but anyway, Dylan Roof, the parent. Gunman in the Emmanuel AME shooting sort of spoiled it for everybody by waving his little Confederate flag around. That's a whole different symbolism. I had an interesting discussion though with Melton McLaurin, who is a retired history professor at UNCW, and he was co-chair with Bertha Todd of the 1898 Commemoration Committee, and he said, and I'm sort of loosely quoting him, you know, this is not a big issue. This is a side issue. The big issues are equality of educational opportunity, equality of employment opportunity. These are the things that are going to change things, and this is what we ought to be focusing on rather than changing the names of streets or parks or anything like that.
That's a really interesting way that you characterized what Dylan Roof did. You said he spoiled it for everybody. There are a lot of people, many of them from northern part or other parts of this country, people who didn't grow up in the South, who don't really have that sense of cultural heritage internalized, who look at the Confederate flag and do see the emblem of the fight to keep slavery, which is, you know, a fight for human oppression. So how do you tease that apart when you're looking at it through a historical lens versus a personal lens, Ben Steelman?
Probably most white Southerners rationalize it by saying, you hear the phrase a lot, it's about heritage, not hate. And they saw their ancestors as fighting to defend their homes. Most Southerners did not own slaves. Certainly most of the privates in the Confederate Army did not own slaves. And they were defending their homes. And when their homes were occupied by the Yankees, they up and deserted to take care of their families. So I think that's part of it. But we have to admit that, yes, slavery was an issue. Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, wrote as much. Bedford Forrest said the same thing, although not as politely as Mr. Stevens did. It's something we have to face.
And when we talk about the reasons behind the Civil War, there are many people who will say this was a fight over states' rights. Slavery was sort of an ancillary issue. Is that true? Is that a smokescreen? Tony Rivenbark.
The underlying cause it had to do with the states' rights were important because people wanted to maintain the slavery as an institution. And it was dying out in the world. In other places, it was gradually being done away with. But you can't sugarcoat it. In the bottom line, that's what it was about. And it was about money, and money was tied in with slavery. That was the wealth of the South, was based in human flesh. And you take that away, then great part of the wealth is gone. So, yes, money, states' rights, power, The country was divided in a sense evenly to some degree, but it was beginning to shift toward the northern manufacturing, and the Southerners resented that. But still, you can't take that slavery as the underlying bottom dark side of this, no matter how you slice it.
We have some rich historical sites right here in the Wilmington area related to the Civil War. Fort Fisher, for instance. For folks who aren't familiar with that, Ben Steelman, can you tell us what Fort Fisher is and why
Fort
it was
Fisher,
important?
Fort Fisher guarded the new inlet into the Cape Fear River and up to Wilmington. The new inlet no longer exists. It was closed in the late 1800s in a massive Corps of Engineer project led by the father of Henry Bacon. Bacon later became famous as the architect of the Lincoln Memorial, and he's actually buried here in town. But anyway, that kept the port of Wilmington, which is normally a very small, insignificant port, open, even as other Confederate ports were closed. And Robert E. Lee famously wrote that if Wilmington fell, he would not be able to keep his army in the field. And in fact, the Army of Northern Virginia lasted barely 90 days after the fall of Fort Fisher. So it's a battle that's often overlooked. When the final battle occurred in January of 1865, there are only about 1,800 Confederates on one side and about four times that many Union soldiers and sailors on the other. But it was a very strategic battle, and more people recognize that.
We have an email from George Thomas in Wilmington. He says, less reported is the fact that many in the southern states opposed secession. There were pockets of resistance throughout North Carolina. He says, any resistance in Wilmington? And we'll let the two of you think about that during the break and answer it when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a trip through the history books with Tony Rivenbark of Thalian Hall and Ben Steelman of the Star News. Do you have a question about a piece of local history, whether it's true or just urban legend? Do you have your own family history from this area to share? Give us a call. Ask your question at 910-343-1138. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio today, Ben Steelman of the Star News and Tony Rivenbark of the Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts. We're exploring this area's local history through the swamps and gardens, and if you've always wondered about some aspect of the Cape Fear region's history, now is your chance to ask about it. You can call us at 910-343-1138, email us at coastline@whqr.org, or tweet us using CoastlineHQ. And just before we went to break, I read an email from George Thomas, who is from Wilmington, and he says, less reported is the fact that many in the southern states opposed secession, pockets of resistance throughout North Carolina. Any of that resistance in Wilmington, Ben Steelman?
Not as much as in the western part of North Carolina when there were fewer slaves, but there were little flashes. There was a sort of secretive organization called the Heroes of America. And William Henry Chase Whiting was convinced that these people had infiltrated the salt works on the coast and were like signaling to the Union ships in the blockade off the coast and everything. But it was not very. There was not very much other than that. There was a pretty lively debate over secession in Wilmington before the state went out in 1861. George Davis, the guy whose statue is at 3rd and Market Street, was a member of a commission that went up to Washington early in 1861 in an effort to paper over the differences and get a reconciliation. But basically, when Fort Sumter fell and Abraham Lincoln issued his call to the states for troops, that pretty much decided most white North Carolinians, and North Carolina went out on May 20th, 1861, which was supposed to be the anniversary of the famed Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. Of course, black North Carolinians were not consulted on this.
Of course. And another important local historical site in the Civil War was the Moore's Creek Battleground. What happened there?
That's revolutionary.
That's revolutionary. So,
oh, thank you. Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one, when we talk about sites, we think of Thalian Hall as an important Civil War site because it was the center of entertainment in that period. In Wilmington, with 2,000 blockade ships coming in, most of the people sat around and waited for a ship to come in. There was nothing else to do but party. And this was the party town in the South, and one of the things people did was go to the theater. And from January 1864 to January 1865, there were over 300 different productions in Thalian Hall. That's how busy theater was because people had nothing to do while they were waiting for these blockade runners to come in.
Wilmington was a Civil War boom town. Most of the old residents moved out or moved inland for safety, but there are all these speculators, all these people who are getting stuff imported on the blockade runners. There are all of these young Royal Navy officers on reserve or half pay who are commanding or acting as officers on these blockade runners, and basically they were behaving like sailors in a port. There's a famous letter, it's in one of Dr. Andrew Howell's books, recounting a witness seeing a Royal Navy officer in fox hunting scarlets riding on the back of a poor Wilmington constable and whipping him with his riding crop. It was just terrible.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about southeastern North Carolina's history. What's rumor and what's fact? We have a couple of crack historians here to answer your questions. Tony Rivenbark, Executive Director of Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts and author of Images of America, Thalian Hall, and Ben Steelman, Star News staff reporter, columnist, and host of Prologue. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Daryl from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm not originally from Wilmington, and I've heard a lot of stories about maybe 100 years ago, a lot of black people were killed, land was taken. I don't know the whole story. I just like to hear the story.
Daryl, that's an excellent question, and we'll let Ben Steelman start with the coup d'etat of 1898.
That's right. Wilmington was from 1865 till 1898 was a pretty good place to live for African Americans. They sort of held a political balance of power. They were able to get a lot of local offices, particularly when they went into. When the local Republicans went into coalition with the populists, there were aldermen, policemen, all sorts of people, and of course there was a thriving African American newspaper edited by Mr. Alex Manley. But in 1898, the Democratic Party worked hard to take over the town, having lost control. Powers that be wanted to get control of the tax power again, and after a really mean election where people called red shirts, who were wearing red shirts, were riding around and intimidating African American voters at the polls, there was an ultimatum for all of the local officers to quit. An armed mob. Basically burned down Alex Manley's newspaper office and then went wild in town. At one point, several members of the local militia company were riding around with a Gatling gun on a wagon shooting into buildings. Now, you sometimes hear that the Cape Fear River ran red with blood. That seems to go back to a rather intemperate comment by Alfred Moore Waddell, who became the new Democratic white mayor of Wilmington after the riot, who said that if no one cooperated, the river would run red with blood. Now, how many people died? That is still a mystery. It might have been as lowball estimates are 10. You see other estimates like 20 to 25, but. There might have been more that were hidden or not reported. We just don't know. The fact is that a number of black and white Republican leaders were basically read out of town on the rail, escorted down on the to the railroad station and put on the first train north. Thousands of other African American citizens headed into the woods and eventually left the city. The population actually dipped quite a bit after 1898.
And just to be clear about the landscape here, before that event, it was fairly progressive in terms of the rest of the United States, wasn't it?
Yes.
New
Hanover County was electing African Americans to the state legislature.
And when you say forced officers out, you're talking about elected officials.
Yes.
Reivenbach.
Not too long ago, a couple of years ago, there was a documentary done about that, and they wanted to film it in the ballroom of City Hall. Well, that was not where the city council met. The city council has only been meeting in the second floor of City Hall since 1990. They never met on the second floor. Where they met is what is now the city manager's office. That was the mayor's court, and that's where the elected officials met from the Civil War period until the 1940s. So when the aldermen, the group of aldermen, were sitting down and the Waddell and that crowd came in and said, "You have to resign," out on the streets were filled with armed people to essentially enforce that will. And they could see it from that window. You can't see 3rd Street from the ballroom if you're sitting at a desk, but you can from Sterling Cheatham's office. You could see that. And so they changed. They shot the film downstairs so that you could see that crowd of people. But it would have been quite evident, and evidently was a very intimidating force of all these armed people, and every one of the aldermen resigned. And that was one of the most one of the few examples of a armed coup d'etat that held and was not treated and was not disciplined in any way by the government.
Is it true?
History.
Yeah,
in
that
American
is the
history.
Only coup d'etat that we know of in American.
Some people say that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of other instances of something similar to that, but this was very specific.
And
the collector of ports of customs was a major federal position at that point, and that was an African-American.
Right.
And we know that the elected officials were forced out. That's pretty well documented.
Oh, it's absolutely documented.
What about the loss of wealth and land for local residents, people who were African-American, who were forced out of their homes?
I think that gets a lot fuzzier.
It does. Some people, a lot of people like Alex Manley moved north and maybe
Alex Manley, the publisher of the newspaper,
and they lost their material. Others sort of hung on as long as they weren't a threat to anybody. The fact is, of course, that Wilmington's economy needed black labor to work. So, I mean, I've always sort of felt like 1898 wasn't like a massacre. It was more like a botched lobotomy or attempt at a lobotomy. They were trying to eliminate the black middle class,
and they succeeded
to a great extent.
You know, there were certain families that continued to stay on and still on to this day,
like
but
the Sag
a lot
Wars,
of people
for example.
Yeah. And Manley was, interestingly enough, was actually a descendant of a former white governor, which I find also very interesting.
Yes.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about some of the local history in southeastern North Carolina with Tony Reivenbach of Thalian Hall and Ben Steelman of the Star News. We have an email from Sam who says, "I've heard all my life that there was at one point tunnels used downtown to move supplies and slaves under to the river. Is there any truth to this story?"
There are a lot of brick-lined tunnels dating from the late 1700s and early 1800s. The most famous being Jacob's Run, which runs under the Bricks nightclub and all the way up to St. James Church. Father Abrams once showed me a little doorway where you can open up and get in there. The sad fact, though, seems to be that these were sewers, and though you get all sorts of great romantic stories that pirates hid booty in there, or that the Underground Railroad smuggled slaves out through there, or anything. Doesn't seem to be much evidence for that.
Jacob's Run actually starts up there above what used to be the law enforcement center, mm-hmm. and it runs down And when you look at the old courthouse, you see how low the right side is between that and the judicial building. It's really very low. You go way down to the ground. Well, that was a stream, the basically that ran down. Eventually, they bricked up that all the way down to so they could build streets and things. Because downtown, you know, Wilmington is built on a bluff with that was a very hilly area. There were seven large hills. Bill Reeves referred to it as the seven sand dunes of Wilmington, like the seven hills of Rome. And gradually over the years, was trying to level this off for building. So you had this tremendous disparity between height and low. Thalian Hall stands on one of those hills, and the bottom of that hill is on the other side of the courthouse. And evidently at one point on 3rd Street actually was a bridge across 2nd. It was that low-lying area. But gradually over the years, it sort of smoothed it off.
And Tony Rivenbark, I want to ask you about Thalian Hall in a second, when it was built and why. But first, we have a note here. I guess Nick from Leland called and said he just left this message, wants to thank Tony Rivenbark for being so frank in discussing the Civil War. He says, you still hear comments that are discriminatory towards Yankees, and there's still a North-South divide.
Yeah, there is.
So Thalian Hall, when was it built, and why did local leaders decide that this community could support a theater of that
size?
Well,
first of all, it had a theater right there where Thalian Hall stands for 50 years, so it wasn't a new idea. But the city had grown. The city was the largest city in the state. The city government was operating out of rented space on Princess Street. The courthouse had moved from the center of Front and Market to the corner of Princess and 3rd, not where the courthouse is now, but the one with that new bank building. That's where the courthouse was. So the city, operating out of rented space, wanted a new seat of government, and they began to eye the property directly across the street where the old Ennis Academy stood, which was a school that had a theater in it. And the school was no longer in operation. And at the back was another school called the Oddfellow School, which wasn't torn down until 1925. So the Antebellum Thalian Association, the fourth group of that name, had been organized in 1846-47. And they were using the theater. But for years, the Wilmington papers had talked about the need for a proper theater. And theaters in those days, particularly in provincial towns, did not just serve drama. They were the assembly room. They were the convention center where you could have big events, even political rallies, because you didn't have the media that we're talking on. If you're making a political speech, you need a room with enough people to come in to help support your cause. So
Frederick Douglass lectured there
right,
at one point.
Yes, he did. And then there was also another group that were interested in a library. So, and then the Home Guard, which was sort of the National Guard of the day, the Wilmington Light Infantry and the Cape Fear Guards, they needed a place to store their armaments. So all these forces came together, which is why this massive building. It's almost if they decided we really want a grand building. So now let's think of all the things we can put in it.
Ben Steelman.
Well, see, this is happening in the 1850s, which were really flush times for Wilmington. The town was making a lot of money off of what were called naval stores, tar, pitch, and turpentine, which you needed back in the days when ships were wooden. There was a lot of rice culture coming out of the plantations like Orton and Belvedere on the Cape Fear River. Not so much cotton, not so much tobacco. That would come later. But the town was prospering. It had gotten up to the incredible size of slightly less than 10,000 people by the 1860 census. That made it, oddly enough, the largest town in the state of North Carolina, and it would remain that way into the 20th century. And all of a sudden, you have all these public buildings going up. Dr. John D. Bellamy builds his gorgeous house on Fifth Avenue about this time. He brings in Rufus Brunel, a Vermont architect, to do the work. And First Baptist Church raises a brand new building right across the street from Bellamy Mansion with this enormous steeple that was apparently at one point the tallest steeple in North America. at least very briefly. Of course, this is the steeple that fell down in Hurricane Fran in 1996 and was replaced at great expense and effort by the congregation.
Let's take it back a little bit earlier. This area was populated by indigenous peoples before European settlers arrived. Who were some of those people? Do we know?
Not very much. There was a tribe called the Cape Fear Indians who encountered Verrazano in 1522 and Captain Hilton when he was bumping around here around 1660 or so. They were not a very big tribe. Generally, they would come down to the coast during the summers and feast on clams and oysters and fish. Then apparently about the time hurricane season got started, they'd move inland, live in the woods, hunt deer. They had some simple simple agriculture going. Not too many of them, and they pretty much disappeared very early in the 1700s. There was a big Indian uprising called the Yemassee War, and the Moore family came up from who had found Brunswick Town came up from South Carolina and basically went Indian fighting, and there were not too many Cape Fear Indians left, and they were gone. And it's speculated that some of them might have moved into the swamps up in what's now Robeson County and become part of the Lumbee Nation, but we don't know that.
We've never been able to figure that out.
And then disease, I think, was another big factor,
right,
too. So the numbers all over the place, began to decline in all of the Indian tribes. But, that were the bones that were found at Thalian Hall, where supposedly this indigenous people, actually going back to before Columbus, because quite often they buried, if someone died, they would bury them on top of a hill.
The bones at Thalian Hall. I'm going to have to ask you more about that when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We have two crack historians in the house today, Tony Rivenbark and Ben Steelman. If you'd like to ask a question about local history or you'd like to share a quick family story and you're from this area, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. We'll take a short break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Tony Rivenbark, Executive Director of the Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts, and Ben Steelman, staff writer and columnist at the Star News. We're traversing the waters of local history today, and if you'd like to ask a question of our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. And right before we went to break, Tony Rivenbark dropped a juicy little morsel about bones being found at Thalian Hall. Tony, when were bones found and who did they belong to?
In the 1990 renovation, when we expanded the building and added the new lobbies and all, and working in the auditorium itself, there were some portions of bones found. And of course, the work stopped and all this stuff. And it was sent off for investigation, and it turns out they were pre-Columbian. But more recently, work on the county administration building, the old Tidewater Power and Light building that's being redone now, they found some too. And these actually were not. These were later.
How much later do we know?
I don't know, but they were parts of coffins, so probably early 1800s. Thalian Hall has been occupied by a building continuously since 1803. Prior to that, there wasn't anything on that block at all. It was really on the edge of town. Bass Thurb was getting into the edge of town. St. James was on the way out of the city. And the little tiny cemetery back of St. James, well, that was really the only cemetery in Wilmington for well over 100 some years until the mid-19th century when Oakdale was built. So I think that you'd be hard put. If you dig pretty much anywhere within two blocks of St. James, you are liable to find bones. So I don't find it surprising at all anybody's going to find that.
Ben Steelman.
Yeah, a lot of graves from from the St. James Burial Ground. A lot of the gravestones were later moved to Oakdale up on 16th Street, which by the 1850s was the outskirts of town, way out in the country. It was a country cemetery, and even more removed when St. James added its parish hall right across the street from the Temple of Israel, and they're still there. Quite a few interesting people in St. James Cemetery. Thomas Godfrey, who was the first Native American playwright. Not a very good one, I understand from Tony, but he was there. He died of yellow fever while vacationing at the coast, and he's buried in St. James Churchyard. Also, Major George Washington Glover, who came to an untimely end, and he was mainly famous for his wife, who moved up to Boston and became Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of the First Church, the Church of Christ Scientist.
910-343-1138. If you have a question for our historians, Ben Steelman and Tony Rivenbark. Larry from Regalwood, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much. I was just curious. There's a road in Brunswick County called Mount Misery Road, and I've heard stories that they used to walk the slaves to Fayetteville that way. I was wondering if there was any truth to some of those stories you hear about Mount Misery Road, and I'll just listen off air.
Okay, thank you so much, Larry. That's a great question. Do we know the history of Mount Misery Road? How did it get that name?
Well, the story is that they did walk slaves along that pathway, and that it sort of acquired that name, and that's the story I've always heard. It's interesting. There's also very nearby on the Cape Fear River a point that was known as Negro Head Point. Apparently, this actually predates the Civil War and slavery in 1898, but it is known that at points on the Cape Fear River in 1832, Nat Turner, a black preacher, led a slave rebellion in Virginia that actually killed several dozen white people before they were put down, and that basically created a panic throughout the South, including North Carolina, and in several places, slaves that were suspected of being conspirators were executed, and their heads were mounted on poles as an example to others.
That's a horrifying image. We have an email. This person writes, I was wondering, I learned a lot about Wilmington's coup d'etat this year in school, but it seems as though a bit of it wasn't taught correctly. Can you highlight the main points of the coup d'etat? And I think that we did that a little earlier, and I would encourage this writer to write back if there's a specific question you have about that time. But can we sort of do some bullet points on that leading up to?
One of the things, I mean, there was the whole political issue and the struggle for power and the former Southern Confederate soldiers who were basically the Democratic Party wanted the power back. But then there was an editorial that was in a paper somewhere in Georgia, I think it was, and Manley reproduced that editorial in his paper, and that was kind of the spark because it had to do with sexuality and that's what really set the groups off. But there were several different groups who were plotting this. There was the Secret Nine. There was the Wilmington Light Infantry crowd. There was a number, and there were a lot of people who had migrated to Wilmington in the late 19th century who were looking for work, and a lot of African Americans had jobs, and a lot of these people did not have jobs. So there were so many issues a part of this. It was about a lot of things, but that spark was that editorial.
Yeah, it was actually a response to a speech at Tybee Island, Georgia, by Rebecca Lattimore Felton, mm-hmm. who was oddly enough a prominent feminist in the South, who was talking about the need to protect women from black beast rapists who were supposedly threatening them all over the South. And Manley sort of jocularly stuck a pin in her argument, suggesting that at least some of what was going on was consensual. And it was nothing that people would find objectionable today, but the white crowd just went ballistic on this. Josephus Daniels of the Raleigh News Observer reprinted it to make sure everybody knew this horrible thing was being said. And anyway, Manley was a marked man, and he and his brother had to very quickly leave town before all the unpleasantness got started.
And a lot of once all this stuff started going, there were these big rallies, and a lot of them were held at Thalian Hall, where these speeches, which were all sort of revving up the people into this thing, which then eventually led to the action of the coup d'etat and basically tamped the down. And from the business standpoint, some of the business people, leaders in the community, were afraid that Wilmington sort of the friendliness and the success of the black community in business here would hurt them in further economic development. So as I say, there were all many, many different thoughts and process going into this stuff. But when it all happened, it was a very sad and tragic situation.
Ben Steelman.
If your reader wants to learn more, I'd suggest a couple of books. One of them
is
We Have Taken a City by a black historian named W. Leon Prather. And the other is, I believe the title is A River of Blood, which was written by a young North Carolina historian Leray Umfleet as part of the 1898 commemoration with support from state government, which is extremely well researched, and that can fill out a lot of details for your caller.
That's great. And we're jumping way ahead here chronologically. We have less than 10 minutes in the show, but Sheila Brothers tweets, ask Tony and Ben how film originally got its start here in Wilmington before the studios were built.
Well, I'm going to throw in here that it really was Frank Capra Jr. because
and we're talking about the 80s,
right? In
early
the 80s,
1980s.
Yeah, 83 is really when. But Dino was looking for a place for the shop for the sequence in Firestarter,
the headquarters of this rogue spy agency.
And Frank Capra saw this picture of Orton, and that's really where that's how it all started. And they came down to. Had negotiated with the Sprunt family to use Orton, and then they made the film. And there was Wilmington was very welcoming to the film community, and Dino decided he'd build a studio here.
He wanted to build what he wanted called a mini major studio for years, and he picked this as his location, and then went to work, and it was pretty good for about 4 or 5 years, and then he had to sell out. But anyway,
and how has the film industry and the arts industry, I'm thinking about the theatrical landscape, really, Tony Rivenbark. Mm-hmm. How have those two disciplines sort of fed each other and intertwined?
Well,
here?
I think when it was going full speed ahead, you know, it was a very attractive place for people to look at the idea and say, well, I need to move somewhere and I'd love to be able to do film, or I am doing film and maybe I can get a chance. So a lot of people were attracted to Wilmington. And that had a tremendous influence on the quality of the theater and all of that here.
Ben
Steelman. One factor I'd add is UNCW and a lot of pioneering theater teachers like the late Doug Swink, the late Terry Rogers. They trained a cadre of young people who later basically became the grunts and the grips and the water carriers and occasionally walk on actors who basically provided the real muscle for the early part of the film industry here, and that played a big part in the film industry taking off. I have one Firestarter story. I remember when the movie first opened in Wilmington, and there's a scene at the top where David Keith and Little Drew Barrymore are being chased through this amazing crowd of men that's supposed to be downtown New York, and it's Front Street, and it's crowded with people, and it's dark, and the audience burst into laughter. It wasn't a funny scene, but the thing was, in 1985 in Wilmington, you did not see anyone on the streets much after sundown.
It was just absurd.
Except maybe on the 4th of July when they would go down to see the fireworks. I mean, the town was dead. I mean, and it was just a few discount stores, some adult bookstores, a couple of really, shall we say, colorful bars. And the film industry helped revitalize downtown and turned it into a money-making proposition, a place where people would really actually like to live.
Now, go ahead, Tony.
To tying that in, you have to talk about I-40 and the film, because they all happened all about the same time. The renovation of Thalian Hall, I-40, the film industry.
When did I-40 connect?
1989.
Yeah, and so all of this stuff was bubbling, and that really did make change. And so that scene of Firestarter, now downtown looks like that on the weekends.
Okay, we have less than 5 minutes left in the show, and there are a couple of things I really think we need to get to. We have a huge battleship sitting right outside of our studios on the Cape Fear River in downtown Wilmington. It's currently a museum of sorts. And Ben Steelman, you played a personal role in bringing it to Wilmington, didn't you?
Well, the reason it's in Wilmington was thanks to a gentleman who was born here by the name of Hugh Martin. He was the chairman of the State Battleship Commission. The government was going to scrap this World War II battleship, and they decided they wanted it as a tourist attraction. And Morton who later, of course, became the owner of promoter of Grandfather Mountain, was a genius at promotion. And he basically had an appeal to every school child in North Carolina, and every school child who donated 10 cents got a free ticket to the battleship once it opened. Now, I gave my entire life savings in the first grade. I gave 12 cents.
Wow.
And I remember about some months later, that ticket comes in the mail, and I'm ricocheting around the house. And sure enough, the first thing as soon as school gets out, my poor dad has to pile the family in the car, drive down to Wilmington, and spend several hundred bucks in 1963 money to motels, meals, and gas, so we could use that free ticket. And thousands of other little Wilmington kids North Carolina kids were doing the same thing. So that's helped the battleship for one thing, basically be a self-sustaining entity for close on 50 years now.
Now, earlier in this edition, we alluded briefly to the Bellamy Mansion. For those folks who aren't familiar with it, it's the spectacular antebellum home. When was it built? And Tony Reichenbach.
Well, it was built really at the same period of time as Thalian Hall, you know, 1858 or whatever. Funny story, before they did the restoration thing, a bunch of volunteers came over one Saturday afternoon to help take some of the charbroiled furniture out because it had been burned during racial disturbances in the 1970s. And so we were loading stuff out, and Emma Bellamy Williamson Hendren, who was one of the most colorful characters ever lived in Wilmington, she was like Auntie Mame, and she came to sort of personally supervise. So she set up deck chairs there in the front hall. And I was coming up the stairs, and there was a young man who I did not know who was in the front loading some stuff. And I was hearing the tail end of the conversation. And he said, "Oh, well, no, I've just moved here. I'm not, you know, from Wilmington, but I'm now living here." And Emma said, "Newcomer's all right. Newcomer's all right. Native is better, but newcomer's all right." And I thought I would fall on the floor. Now, you could always count on Emma having something interesting to say.
Now, Emma, she had been entertainment director on the old Atlantic Coastline Railroad.
That's exactly right.
Back in the 20s.
Yes, she was the hostess on the club car. But I don't think that lasted too long.
That's this edition of Coastline. Obviously, this conversation will continue after the microphones go off. I'd like to thank our guests, Ben Steelman and Tony Reivenbark. Thanks also to you, our listeners, and those of you who called and emailed your comments. Join us for the next Coastline. We'll fish out the truth behind shark safety and the recent spate of injuries from these creatures along the coast. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline is produced by Isabel Shepherd. Our technical director is Ken Campbell. And if you missed part of this show, we'll post it on our website, whqr.org, later today. You can also download the podcast from the iTunes Store. There you'll also find podcasts of earlier shows. Thanks again for listening. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.